Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast focused on game strategy. Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mean Team.
QNL.
With guest co-host
Onondaga.
All right, so I'm going to start the broadcast and then Phil, you know, the introduction after the theme song. Oh, there's a Maggie.
Oh my god, your voice just went like, woo!
It's Maggie, oh my god!
It went up at least 2 octaves.
50% more estrogen. Actually, 100% more estrogen.
Yes.
Welcome to episode 117. I'm Muggaloo, who still needs more caffeine, and with me, of course, is Dan Q.
Yo, home slice!
Oh god, don't do that. You're too white to do that. The Mean Team.
Have I got some units for you?
And Lisa Payne, Q&L.
Hello!
In the news, a new civilization and scenario pack and explorer's map pack downloadable content for Civilization 5 is to arrive on the 3rd of May. We assume the pricing point is going to be comparable to what the other DLC has been, although I don't think that specifically has been announced. But more to the point, it's the Denmark civilization and the explorer's map pack. I'm going to talk about the map pack first. We do have some audio clips with regards to the Denmark civilization. But before that, the Explorer map pack, we're looking at 10 single-player maps. 5 of the maps are based on real-world locations chosen for their historical interest and gameplay possibilities. The remaining 5 are scripted map environments. Change from game to game, but we'll focus on exciting gameplay theme, such as Sandstorm and Amazon, and from the Caribbean to the Bering Strait. Quote, these maps will give skillful Civilization V players new lands to conquer, unquote. So I'm not sure what more to be said about that until we actually get a chance to play them.
And also, Danish Norwegian ski infantry. What?
God,
they
that
call
is funny.
This the Scandinavia civilization since they're, you know, mixing things here.
I will turn on my combat animations just to see them fight.
They're going downhill even when there's no hills. What's the what?
What's my ski infantry? Like, do they have guns?
Depends on the era a little bit. I would imagine modern ski infantry would carry firearms, yes.
Yeah, it's not like they're going to throw snowballs or something.
Well, they might, but...
They do that when they have ammo, Lisa.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
What do you think they use in their mortars? Gosh.
They just launch skis at you.
To give us a little bit of an overview of the civilization, again, this is a sound clip, and it's from Pete Murray, who's the marketing associate at Firaxis Games, and is going to give us a bit of a rundown on... the Denmark civilization, the Danish civilization, and then we'll discuss, and then we'll listen to what he has to say about the scenario.
Let's meet the King of the Danes, Harald Bluetooth. In Civilization V, each civ has a unique ability, and Denmark's is called Viking Fury. Embarked units have extra movement, and these units pay less to move from sea to land. This means the Danes can storm ashore on an invasion, and defenders can't count on a turn of fighting the Danes with their backs to the sea. You'll also find this ability handy early in the game as you start to explore the world. The Danes have 2 unique units during the game. The first is the Berserker, which replaces the Long Swordsman unit. It has the amphibious promotion, meaning that it doesn't take a penalty fighting from the sea or over a river. This means your opponent can't use rivers as natural walls for his units or cities. It also gets an extra point of movement, fast and hard-hitting, just like a Berserker should be. Scandinavia is the birthplace of the Winter Biathlon, so it's only right that Denmark's other unique unit is the Norwegian Ski Infantry. These riflemen replacements move faster and fight harder on clear hills and in snow and on tundra. Ever invaded an enemy civilization across the poles? Now you'll get a chance to do just that with the Ski Infantry. The Danes are all about the shock effect of their infantry. There are going to be eras in the game where you'll have some of the finest troops in the world at your command, ready to storm ashore with the fury of the Northmen. In addition, their units can pillage a tile at no cost to movement. So if you don't have the satisfaction of beating your enemies, you may at least have the satisfaction of messing up his tile improvements.
Yeah, I don't really understand... well, no, I'm not going to go on my DLC rant again, but... Well, just insert DLC rant here. Like, I don't know. I feel like they come out with this $3 thing, like, every month. And, I mean, if you think about it, that's, like, the price of, like, a phone game, you know? So, in terms of, like, price point, like, that's where they're at, you know? People will just think, oh, this is something new to play, and I already paid, like, $3 for a small game. So, I don't know. It's just, yeah, I resent that. That's a lot of money you could be blowing on DLCs.
So, listeners, just so you're aware, random events in Civ 4 for me is kind of similar to DLC for Q&L in Civ 5. Similar comparisons. We're still working on her rants, but we'll get her there. No worries.
I'll get my diatribe coach, and we'll go over some things.
Yeah.
Also, I don't really understand this, like, satisfaction thing from pillaging. I don't know if I've ever felt really satisfied when I'm pillaging stuff.
Well, I had more satisfaction pillaging cottage tiles in Civilization 4.
Oh, yeah.
Not as much as resources. Maybe strategic resources or some luxury resources from time to time, but I don't pillage as much, no.
Strategic resources are awesome to pillage, especially if they don't have a lot of strategic resource units yet. And that goes for both games. They can't build anything of value then for some periods of time. And that's pretty satisfying to know that no matter what they build, it's not going to be that good against anything you have in the field because they don't have any strategic resources.
Was that your iron? Oh, I guess you can't tag me with those swordsmen anymore. Aha.
Yeah, and the mobility is less of a factor in Civ 5 in enemy territory than it was in Civ 4. Just because, you know, while you can't use enemy roads, you can move more tiles in between cities in Civ 5, but it still matters. And cutting the roads still could make a difference. Certainly it could in Civ 4 as well. When you're playing against the AI, it'll tend to shuffle its defenders around, and, well, if you pillage its ability to do that, you know, well, then you can start intercepting units outside of cities where their defensive bonuses are pretty lackluster to nothing and get a lot of easier kills than you would have had otherwise. So it's not something you want to do constantly, but if you pillage strategically, it can be pretty satisfying in both games.
I don't know. I'm starting to compare when it comes to the fact that not so much about the embark units have extra movement, but less movement cost to move from sea to land, so you'll be able to land and then attack, which is of course handy for exploration and amphibious assault. But then you can also attack from the ocean without that combat penalty. So in terms of the exploration aspect and just the usefulness of, you probably want some kind of water-based map for these guys, just like Polynesia. I don't know, if you're dealing with a Pangaea or something, or some other map that's really limited in terms of the water, its Viking fury is kind of a fizzle.
Well, if you're talking about an easy, like if you're not taking amphibious penalties attacking onto land, you can probably get away with some things that other civilizations can't in situations that would otherwise be a bit more choking, in that you only have so many units at being able to attack from one set of hexes to the next. Now you effectively have an additional hex from which you can attack and maneuver, and as long as you're careful about not getting your units picked off at sea, you can do pretty well with that.
You know, I was just thinking, like, I bet that, like, the release of this civilization has something to do with the release of Thor, like, next week. You know that Thor's coming out? I mean, come on!
I hope you're wrong, but that's a funny thought for certain.
Product placement.
Yeah, they were in cahoots with each other all along. They were developing.
Well, I don't know. It seems coincidental that they're coming out at the same time. And also, I mean, since when do they, like announce DLCs, like, a long time before they release them, you know? I don't know. Oh, yeah, we're working on this DLC.
Oh, hi.
Yeah. So I don't know why they're making such a big deal out of it.
Maybe it's a change in marketing strategy. You look at these DLCs, and maybe if you hype them up a little bit, they get sold more. Certainly other game titles have attempted that in the past, and well, with apparent success, but I don't know. I've never really been inside on the industry to know. But it might be effective. We'll see if they get more downloads than the other ones.
It also seems like in a post from Mousy Pounds over on CFC, there were some questions with regards to, well, for instance, a minor thing with regards to some city-state names in the case of Copenhagen and Oslo, that now that we're going to be introducing the Danish civilization, could we end up with two cities of the same name in a game? And it looks like from the latest patch for Civilization V, which you talked about last week, whatever its number it ended up having to be, that in looking at the XML, Mousy Pounds did, notice that it has been prepared for a DLC where Copenhagen will now be known as Sydney, and Oslo is going to be called Quebec City, it looks like.
Oh. Australia is going to be a city-state, what?
Quebec City.
Yes, and when a Canadian city becomes a city-state, woohoo!
Yeah, but they picked Quebec. They picked the Frenchies.
That's okay. That's okay. It's still Canadian, and this is the first step to the Canadian Civilization as DLC. And I guess there's also a scenario that's going with this as well. 1066, Year of Viking Destiny. So why don't we just turn it to Pete Murray from Firaxis to tell us a little bit more about that.
Our scenario in this DLC pack is set in the British Isles in the year 1066. The object of the scenario is to complete the Domesday Book National Wonder in London before the end of the game. To do this, you have to build 6 Domesday Shire courts in cities away from London to show that you control the island. You'll always be at war with your rivals in this scenario, and the technologies and social policies are locked. This is a scenario about conquest and control, and whether you're William the Conqueror or Harald Hardrada, you'll win by proving yourself King of the Britons on the field of battle.
Okay, in fairness, you probably don't want to ask me what I think about this scenario, because I'm not a scenario person, so I'm just going to go, meh. I have no opinion.
I have an opinion.
It well, seems like you have like, a lot of your options blocked, but it could be fun to try it, like a lot of the scenarios once or twice. But, you know, we'll just have to wait until we see it as well. Because sometimes you get unexpected depth in these things. I wouldn't hold my breath for a scenario that's locking a lot of your options in the game, but maybe, maybe. And certainly it'll be something different as a change-up to look at. Now, I don't do a lot of the scenarios, but every once in a while I'll check one out, and just depending.
Pretty much covered it all. Personally, though, I'm not going to get it because of the price, so...
Yeah, I'm agree. Have you bought any DLCs?
No, I'm going to wait. I'm pretty sure that they're going to bundle them up anyways eventually.
I agree.
So.
Yeah, I've kind of waited for that myself.
But you already bought them, didn't you?
Me? No. Maybe?
Oh, okay. Okay, never mind. I thought Mackie had bought some, but she didn't.
No, I think there was one they put out for free. I think I've got that or something, but no.
Yeah,
on
the Mongols, yes.
Let me try my ability here at a segue. Speaking of finding Sydney and Quebec City, I find myself doing almost no exploring as a thread started by Red Ralph on the 2K forums. I can't work out the gameplay reasons for it, but in Civ 5, I do a hell of a lot less exploring than I did in Civ 4. Anyone else notice this? Quote unquote. I have noticed that I disagree with you.
Yeah, what are you doing not exploring?
Yeah, I can't come up with a gameplay reason for it either. Like you get more money from city states when you meet them first. You get national one, you get those wonders for happiness. You have the ability to deal with more AI if you explore well. I don't see why you wouldn't explore in Civ 5 or Civ 4. There's always options with meeting AIs that you don't have if you don't meet them.
Let's have the other side on here, as it were, in the from the post of Ranero, one of the first responses. If you're going to build some early wonder like Hand Your Library, you need to build Worker and that wonder. You don't have time for Scouts. I usually build Worker and then Library and then National College. It's better to get extra 100% science than trying to find some useless quote-unquote unit upgrade or map of ocean.
Well, now, wait a minute. Is this guy saying that he's not building any scouting units in addition to his early scout unit? Or is he just saying he doesn't bother exploring? Because there's difference here. I mean, you always have diminishing returns when you're building more units to explore. It's probably not worth building more than a couple unless the map is really huge. And by a couple, I mean like maybe a second exploring unit. Because then you're looking at the majority of your continent explored pretty quickly. You're not going to build like six warriors and explore all over the place in the BCs before you start building any workers, wonders, or other things. Unless you just plan on killing somebody.
No, even one or two units out exploring is going to reap you a lot of benefits.
Yeah, and then after that, I don't see the issue here. I don't see any disincentive to explore with one or two units that's strong enough to avoid doing it.
Some people argue here, well, you know, I turn ruins off, and I turn city-states off.
Okay, but you still meet the other civs. You still find out where your resources are, so you can plan your future cities, which you will be building once you get finished with your library and science stuff.
Again, I'm going to continue playing devil's advocate. The response I saw actually from someone, I forget the username, it might be J-A-C-Y-P-R, because there were a lot of reasons in favor of exploring posted by JPBar81, and this other individual was responding. To the thing about meeting civilizations, he says, well, the sooner you meet a civilization, the sooner you get denounced and hated and declared on, and therefore it's not worth it.
Whatever.
What?
Denouncing Dan right now.
So if your diplomacy is terrible, then you might not want to scout. If you're really bad at other aspects of the game, you might as well be bad at another aspect of the game, I guess. I don't know. Certainly, you have ways of manipulating the AIs in Civ 5 such that they do not denounce you. I don't have the link handy, but somebody actually delved into how the some of the AI XML patterns work now for Civilization 5. And there certainly are things you can do to get away with certain actions that I was not aware of, such as if you have enough declarations of friendship and mutual declarations of friendship, you can get away with being a warmonger in those civilizations' eyes, for example, at least for a while. And that can buy you the time you need to get huge and pumped up, just as one example of something you can do with diplomacy. And you're usually not going to get denounced unless you do something to piss the AI off, usually.
Oh, see, I tend to do that a lot. I'd like some stuff. No.
When you do, it's just when you're ready to piss the AI off, then you do it and you screw them over. But until then, you know, you play a little bit nicer.
So yeah, let's assume that you do play with ruins off, and you play with city-states off, maybe even play with barbarians off, because someone also mentioned that, well, actually, JPBar81, his 8th point was finding barbarian camps to attack with your stronger units to get more gold and maybe even city-state influence. Let's assume all of that is turned off. Okay, so you send out your scouts to find out, A, who is around you, of course, because then if you find out, for instance, through additional technology acquisition or even at the start of the game, some of your luxury resources, you've got extra, you've got someone to trade with those extra resources. Or at the very least, perhaps you can find by exploring where you want to settle next, because there's food over here. There's luxury resources I have I can trade. There's strategic resources I don't have. I can block the civilization off from settling far closer to me by blocking them off and being at this first place, or I can, send a unit over there later on to monitor if they're coming closer towards me. Oh, I want a production city because my initial city here's got a lot of, you know, flat land. Oh, there's another place I can settle. So many other reasons to explore, because information is power, and if you have an idea of what's going on in your surroundings, then you can start to influence what you do with those surroundings and how they can help you and also how it can hurt you. There's also the discovering natural wonders as well. Yes, that was pointed out by JPBar81. I don't think you can disable those, although I don't know why you would. Except for maybe one that's tested, but we won't go there again.
I mean, if you pop one of those, or just find a city state that'll pay you, then you pretty much paid for the scout with gold.
There's always El Dorado.
That's the one that we were going to mention, John.
Oh, God.
It's called Gilderado because you have to be a really good player to find it, and only good players find it ever.
And then you have to be a really, really good player to make any practical use of the gains you get, too. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Easily the most skillful feature in the game, aside from perhaps like multiple ruin spawns that are favorable. It just depends, because you have to manipulate the ruins just right, you see.
Yes.
But anyway, yes, exploring is good in every Civ game that I've played, certainly all of the major ones in the series, all of them in the flagship series, 1 through 5, with that getting more valuable as you go along, for the most part.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, I think because of the greater yield from all those things you can find with scouts in Civ 5, yeah, I think there's even more advantages to scouting in this version than the last.
Yeah, I don't know if we mentioned it or not. I was kind of reading the text chat for our channel here, but you can, even just meeting an AI, if you have a luxury resource to sell, you might have a higher bidder if you've met, say, 4 to 5 AIs than you would have if you've met, say, 1 to 2 AIs for your gold, and you might be able to get a little bit more depending on the difficulty level there. So there's lots of reasons to do it. It's certainly worth a while to get some early scouting in.
So it might take you, I mean, depending upon your the speed difficulty, maybe 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 turns, something like that, but what you're going to gain potentially either in the immediate moment, so okay, with ruins, finding barbarian camps, finding city-states, or even if you turn that off, the longer term, the fact that, especially with the scouting, and so when we say actually exploring, we are referring to the scouting unit because it ignores a terrain penalty. And yeah, it's true, the higher difficulty level you go, especially if barbarian, particularly if barbarians are on, the greater the chance is that they're going to meet an untimely demise. And sometimes, occasionally, they could get killed pretty quickly. And then you feel like, oh, I did waste all those turns. But I would say that would be the exception rather than the rule. And I will typically build 2 scouts myself to start off with, 1 to go in one direction and 1 to go in another direction.
Of course, this is also a bit dependent on how big your map size is, because if you do have a smaller map, then there are disadvantages, or not as many advantages to doing it, because there are just fewer things for you to potentially find. But, you know, you can compensate for that by building fewer scouts.
Yes, and your map type, too. Like, if you're playing islands, well, unless you're Polynesia. Oh, I went there.
Lolanesia.
By JPBar81, and according to the XML, it just basically displays what the points for the points are. Like 8 points per city, 4 points per population. And the whole poll is whether or not it should be changed or not, since bow scores can just get like boosted, especially about wonders, wonder bloating.
It is true that I mean, when you take a victory by conquest or domination, you usually end up with a higher score than by other means.
I've always wondered, and I'm not sure if it's actually possible, for score to be more indicative of the civilizations who are likely to win. So often, in all of the Civ titles, human players could come back from like less than half the AI score to go on and win the game. And, you know, that's fine, because the AI is stupid. But so it's just, even if somebody has like 50% more score than you in multiplayer, you can easily lose if you make a mistake. It's just, it seems like score should be a better indicator of who's actually doing well, and maybe you can't do that. In which case, you know, if you're using objective criteria, points per city, pop, land, that's probably, in tech, that's probably as good as you're going to get. I mean, maybe you could add a little bit for military or something else, but when you start doing that, people just start milking it by spamming units for score. So I'm not sure that there's an easy answer here. I mean, they want to drop the points per city, but actually there's a finite limitation of cities on a map, as opposed to, say, population gouging or other things. I remember a technique in Civ 3, what was it called, dogpiling? And that's different from where all the AIs declare on you. The Civ 3 technique, whoa, let's stop that. No, the Civ 3 technique involved like spamming workers and just putting them all in one city, such that you could get huge city populations because it could only shrink by one pop a turn. So you just keep stuffing workers in there and grow it indefinitely and get outlandish scores. So there's ways to game the system for scores in Civ, and this probably doesn't allow too much, but you're always going to have some milking with the score system as long as it's depending on empire size, and that's always going to put a bias towards military victories then.
Oh, the glaring thing that they talked about there was that, you know, there is no, like, increase in score with your level. So, you know, if you do really, really well on Settler or Pre-Settler, it's just, you'll get the same score as if you like, or even higher score than if you wanted a deity or immortal, and that's just not fair. I don't think, you know, it's, I mean, of course, you know, those, you know, pre-settler things are not going to make it to Hall of Fame, But I would like to see, you know, your scores graded like it was in Civ 4.
There's a problem with that too, though. And you start wondering where you draw the line. Because in Civ 4, like, if you were to give me a random deity fractal map, I could probably win somewhere between, like, 20% of the time to 30% of the time, somewhere in that range. But if you just told me to create a map on deity and win it, I could do it almost every time by switching it to Marathon, picking the AI civs I wanted to play against, abusing some of the less savory strategies in the game, like the Apostolic Palace or whatever. And I could win those deity games like nothing, and it would be actually pretty easy to do it. You know, maybe play as Rome and just press stomp everybody on Marathon normal-sized maps. So you have a lot of setting options in all the Civilization games that will allow you to win a difficulty more easily than you would otherwise. And there's really no good way for the score calculations to take that into account, at least not just for a basic Hall of Fame in single player. Certainly Civ 5 Hall of Fame, as well as the previous Hall of Fame iterations for the forums, has at least been trying to get a more realistic picture going. But mostly people just look at finish date for a victory condition in that case, and that might be the best metric in some regards, just because you can't come up with better ones.
Yeah, we've said before that, you know, that score is one measure. And it's true that, to me, when we're talking about score, the fact that the only victory condition that it truly ultimately influences is time. And we've expressed opinions on the time victory condition before. I think it's helpful when you're talking about score that, and it will say, for instance, what your difficulty level is. Because if someone, I ask someone, so what's your science output? And they said, oh, it's 50 a turn. And I say, well, what turn is it? And they say it's 50. My reaction is going to be a little different than if they tell me it's turn 500. So if you tell me your score is 10,000 on Settler, I'll be like, uh-huh. If you tell me your score was 10,000 on Deity, I would be like, OMG. So, but I was just pointing out in the chat, I imagine that, yes, Wonder Whoring is less useful for score than it used to be. And I think rather than going in and trying to scale it for the difficulty level, just make it so that it is abundantly clear, as I think it is already, that when you see this particular score, this is the difficulty level that it's associated with. But let's start adding some other variables in terms of what gets scored. Like it comes up in the thread, for example, social policies obtained, perhaps to help reflect perhaps those that are going towards a cultural victory. And yes, I'm actually talking about it. I think I will survive. I'll take my medication later.
Do it with one city. One city on deity. Oh, you can.
And yes, this the only thing that I'm a little disappointed with regards to the discussion of this thread so far is that the poll hasn't been mentioned yet. Maybe people were waiting for me because they know I love them so.
We're saving the best for last.
Oh, I will not sing whatever her name is that sang the song Save the Best for Last. You can count yourself fortunate.
Well, I won't tell you which one's the best and which one's the last then.
The points earned from number of cities should be increased, remain as is, be decreased, or be removed. Be removed? I'm not even going to go there. Be increased is trailing considerably, whereas remain as is and be decreased is locked. I would be voting, and I haven't voted in this poll yet, but I will, remain as is, and then start looking at other measures so that score is indeed a better reflection of what is actually going on in the game. Okay, and then I guess we actually are going to be talking about the previous Civilization title. Oh my.
Woohoo!
Under Forum Talk, I think Lisa would like to introduce that topic. I think that's what that sound was.
This topic by Jim Otto Fan is called How Do You Stop a Strike? By the way, we're also sponsored by Jim Otto. I was doing fine, and then I found a new continent, and we started colonizing like crazy. I got to the point where my units were disbanding, and it said strike. So I turned a couple of the bigger cities onto wealth, and now I have extra money, but it still says strike. How do I stop the strike? Probably press enter.
Yeah. That would do it.
That's my advice.
Certainly. Anytime your gold income is greater than your expenses, and the number is green at the top left of the screen there, you'll stop strike by ending the turn. And that's good to know. But really, I think the more useful thing to take away from striking is if you're going on a major military conquest, to plan for the possibility of it ahead of time. especially if you're going with an early rush, your options such as courthouses, such as building wealth with the currency technology are very limited, and you're going to have to prepare so that you don't just lose all your units and get rolled because you don't have any military due to strike. Probably the best thing you can do if you're going on an early conquest, something like horse archers or chariots or axes, swords, yeah, maybe Rome or something, whatever, is to turn your slider down to 0% research and just stockpile some gold. And that will allow you some time after you capture cities to grow them and produce commerce. And that's the other thing you're going to want. If you're going to capture a lot of land really early in the game, you're going to want things that allow your cities to grow larger, and you're going to want the ability to get those cities onto commerce tiles. Commerce, when your slider is at 0%, will get all converted into gold. So cottages are basically all those, you know, commerce symbols you're showing are going 100% into gold while you're doing this. And if you can capture enough luxury resources, get your cities, you know, plus 5 beyond what they would normally be, and work a lot of cottages, you would be surprised, even on Immortal and Deity, just how far you can get away with conquering early in the game using only that. And I've come from situations where I was like negative 50 gold per turn at 0% and actually managed not to strike, or only to strike for one turn where you do not lose any units. But you have to plan ahead and have enough gold in the bank to recover in time before you start striking. And then as you get later in the game, you do have options like state property, which takes away the distance maintenance for cities. That's very effective for conquests. You have options like building wealth, which will convert the hammers that a city's producing into gold and can very quickly help you out. Certainly running merchant is a possibility. If you get a great merchant, you can use them on a trade mission and get a lot of gold that way. That's often worth enough in terms of deficit research to get to key technologies such as currency or alphabet or whatever. So you have some options available to you, but you do have to be aware of the potential for strike, and you do have to react to it appropriately. Usually, once you're already in strike, you're kind of screwed. I mean, you might be able to do some tile swapping if you're only losing a couple turns of gold a turn at 0%, but otherwise, it's not so good.
The only things I would add to Phil's very comprehensive answer. First off, with regards to swapping tiles, this can be a particularly fun exercise if you're in a multiplayer game and you're on a turn timer. But
you just have to be faster at it, that's all.
Phil mentioned courthouses, and build a sufficient number of courthouses, then you also want to be building your Forbidden Palace.
Yes, the more extending your empire is, the more that's going to be worth. And you can make a pretty quick guesstimate of how much it's going to be worth to you based on the distant maintenance component of maintenance. And you can see that anytime you go into a city and mouse over the maintenance cost. It'll show you what proportion is from the number of cities versus from distance from palace. And the Forbidden Palace basically functions as a second palace in that the city it's built in will have zero distance from palace maintenance, and then the cities around it will be calculated based on the Forbidden Palace rather than the palace. And of course, if you're state property late game or you bulbed your way there and you're one of those super deity players, you can get it by like 700 AD, then you don't have any distance from palace anyway because you're in state property.
You can also try for the Versailles Wonder too, but hardly necessary.
It's expensive and it's hard to get to Divine Right in a timely fashion, although it's always nice to capture that one.
One other thing is that I've also had the occasion to be on strike while at war, and well, that's never fun either because you're starting to lose units and you're at war, and oftentimes it'll be the, you know, units farthest away, correct me if I'm wrong, from your city or from your civilization. And anyway... I've actually just, you know, been able to go on and get out of strike just by, you know, being able to take over the city somehow and using that goal for at least a couple more turns before I finally have to call it quits, basically, or capture another city. But, you know,
yeah,
you can kind of manage that, you know, like, you know, get a new city and then maybe be in strike for one turn and just kind of keep that going. And, you know, well, in an unsustainable cycle, basically.
You can keep it going even further if you're willing to cut production by constantly switching between civics and religions over and over again. You can just basically buy yourself quite a few extra turns by civic swapping. Now, the downside to that is, of course, that you can't really build anything. Although, if you're willing to chop into cities, you can get some units out during your non-turn, your non-anarchy turns. But that's not going to last you very long, so you're going to have to finish your war and come up with some way to make yourself viable eventually Which is why I was always curious why that was banned in the Hall of Fame, but whatever.
To start a golden age, just to get out of strike for, you know, at least 8 turns, if not more. And that'll work out fine, yeah.
I did that in a recent game. cooperative game, actually.
Was I in that one? I think I
might remember something like that. Yeah, I was at... I have very, really good early conquest, and then some people were like, Dan, you took out your AI so quickly, how come you're not, like, farther along in the tech tree?
Oh, I remember, yeah, I remember this one, that was a custom
time. This was a strike from, like, 30 turns.
Oh, yes. Dan was stricken for so long, it wasn't even funny.
An open mic segment now.
Woo!
We actually have a couple here. And the first one was from an email from Ian DeArdo, saying, just listen to your latest podcast. Very good, by the way. I was interested in the discussion about strategy for Civ 4. I've been a longtime player of this series, but I've really given up on Civ 5 and gone full-time back to 4, like several people I know. I do have two questions, unquote, so we're just going to read the first one, address it, then read the second one. And yes, for those in the audience, I will copy and paste this letter, so you don't have to memorize everything that I say. Question number one, quote, you mentioned looking at save games. I've downloaded a few from Civ Fanatics Hall of Fame, which have been some help. Any suggestions of other sources? I can imagine this would be a real help moving from the middle difficulty levels to higher ones where every move is critical and any waste will haunt you, unquote. Well, there are save games made available outside of the Hall of Fame, both on Civ Fanatics and other Civ fan sites, such as Appleton and We Play Civ, and I think there might even be some on Civ Players as well, as a start.
Well, there's also Watching Phil, because he puts his stuff up on his YouTube channel, and even when he fails, it's educational. As a matter of fact, he's somewhat internet famous, because I've seen other forums have nothing to do with Civ mention his videos to watch.
Man, I don't know about these forums. But that's not a good source of save game. Well, it depends on which game I'm playing. What I'll reference here is the Civilization Fanatics Forum Strategy and Tips subforum specifically, because that's where I did, I would say, the vast majority of my learning for Civilization 4. And, the Civ 5 equivalent as well. I did a lot of my learning there. Well, for what I didn't get from beta. And the Civ 4 Strategy and Tips forums, even now, has active series running where you can play the same start everyone else has and compare how your game went with other people's games. There's the Nobles Club, which is intended for players, you know, at the World or Prince level, although pretty much any difficulty is allowed because those are uploaded as World Builder saves. There's the Monarch Student game. I think that's hosted by Big Time right now. DeLam hosts the Nobles Club. And Big Time's Monarch Student is pretty much just the same thing as Nobles Club, but for Monarch level. Recently, Nihil Zero took over my Immortal University. It really was never my Immortal University, but I hosted it for a long time. So there's that as well. And then there's a couple Deity games going on right now as well. If you're one of the best players in the forum, you can check out the one by Snatty running All of His War. Or you can take on the easier one by a new guy there. So there's actually a lot of saves that you can play from in that forum and compare with screenshots from other players how they played the game versus you. And I do Let's Plays based on some of those games, so you can compare to my videos as well. But there are other sources and other play styles you can see as well. So there's a lot of variety you can get there if you're interested in getting better at Civ 4.
Another set of forum games that can be kind of nice, especially for kind of breaking the routine in Civ, is Mad Scientist's RPGs.
Ah, yes. He also posts those in Strategy and Tips. I forgot to mention him. Yeah, the roleplay challenges. Those are very fun. I've actually Let's Played one of them, but
Julian Assange.
Those games. Yeah, Julian Assange is awesome. Just the name, man. It's good times. Yeah, he comes up with interesting variants, like rules that restrict what he can do, or he must do a certain thing. Like with Julian Assange, we had to turn our slider off and only run espionage after reaching the alphabet technology. So it's very much a spy-oriented game.
Ooh,
kind of cheesed that using gold late game, but the game was already won, so it didn't matter. But yeah, he also has things where like you have to declare war on X civilizations and be nice to the other ones. He had one where I think you had to get into a permanent alliance with Tokugawa. Like you had to do it playing as America. There's a lot of variety there. And you just have some where you can't declare war. It's just, it's awesome. There's a nice, long variety there. And he's gone through all of the leaders at least once, and now he's in a second cycle of that. And similarly, Lonely Hearts Club has also gone through an entire cycle of leaders, and that's playing strictly from isolated starts, which is definitely a unique situation to begin a game in isolation. So yeah, there's a lot of options. You will never exhaust all those saves. I haven't played in all those games, despite how much I've been posting and playing in the past couple of years.
Oh, I take it that Toku game was not random personality or anything like that?
No, it wasn't.
Oh.
But you don't meet them right at the start of the game, so it's actually easier than it sounds, if you know the game well. Because Toku will sign a defensive pact at Pleased. Actually, he's one of the few leaders that will do that for whatever reason. And if you meet him in the mid-game and haven't treated with one of his worst enemies yet, you can just gift him a technology or a bunch of gold right away and get him to +4 Pleased instantly. Then you open borders, maybe run his favorite civic, or at least run his religion, and all of a sudden you can get him to friendly, especially if you share a defensive pact with him for a while, because you get a bonus for that and for open borders. And when you have all that put together, and you need a defensive pact for enough turns, I think it's like 20 or 40, I think it's 40, then you need that for a permanent alliance anyway, so you can do that. And then, of course, if you get into a war, you can get share a war bonus as well. It's actually pretty easy to get him to permanent ally. Now, whether or not it's a good idea is another matter, but he was playing that on Monarch in Marathon, so it was very doable.
That takes us to his second inquiry. Quote, one thing I've enjoyed is using the mods in Civ 4. I never used them before, but I'm a big fan of ROM A New Dawn. There aren't too many strategy discussions on this or other mods that I can see in a quick search, mostly beyond the Sword Vanilla. Do you have any suggestions yourself or places where I could find save games, as there are significantly more choices to work with to make vanilla guides less than optimal? Thanks, and keep up the good work, unquote. It's true that our sibling show Modcast is on a bit of a hiatus, intending to return later this year. They may be of more assistance to you directly when we're talking about mods with Civ 4, but I have noticed even in strategy forums that sometimes the strategy forums, as well as the modding forums themselves, include strategies for using the mods and actually doing well with whatever it does that the mod gives you, in addition to, the tips on how to actually get the mod up and running in the first place. But beyond that, I'm actually not much help in that respect.
One thing mods are legendary for is, it's so hard to balance a game. I would argue that Firaxis didn't even do that well of a job, that when you start adding content and mods, one of the first things that comes to my mind is, okay, where can I break the game in this mod by taking advantage of the new features? That certainly the stock Civ 4 AI was not designed to utilize or to compensate for their existence. So you start seeing, say you have the Civilization Gold mod, which allows a wide variety of civs. Like, you can play as Ukraine, you can play as Canada, among very many other civs. There's so many options in Civ Gold. And you'll get unique units like a 3-strength warrior. And I don't think it takes much imagination to figure out what a 3-strength warrior can do to the early game, as that's even stronger than the Incan unique unit, for example. Certainly, there's stuff on par with vanilla Cossacks and that you can take advantage of. But that's a lot more like a stock Civ game. And I'm always going to recommend Beyond the Sword on Altered Gameplay, the Bug mod, or the mod that Hall of Fame uses, Buffy, which has a couple extra things as well as Beyond Bug. And then you have, Better Beyond the Sword AI that I've used. I really haven't played a lot of mods, so unfortunately I can't offer much help in Rise of Mankind or the popular Fall from Heaven mods. That probably would better be the Realm of Modcast, but if I'd played them, I could probably give some help there, but I'm afraid I just haven't played enough different ones, because I really like to master something when I play it, so there's so many mods, I just couldn't keep up with that.
I wonder whether, all these DLCs have any influence on, how, avid the modders are this time around for Civ 5.
I don't know, because a lot of the DLC, it's really not changing the gameplay directly. You're not going to see a Star Trek DLC from Firaxis, at least I hope not. But, there's some interesting mods along those lines, or something like Fall from Heaven, a complete fantasy setting. You're probably not going to see that from, other than the Fountain of Youth, maybe, from Firaxis. So yeah, I'd say that the modders have a lot of directions they can go in Civ 5, even with DLC that won't conflict. And certainly some of the mods out there could do something to address the user interface. I think some of them have already.
Well, yeah. You know, I mean, with this new patch coming out, hopefully it'll be easier for modders to do their work too, because
yes,
yeah, it's
been much demanded from patch to patch, because the modders, it's not as easy for them as they were expecting, based on the fact that Firaxis advertised the moddability of Civ 5 to be the best ever, essentially. And certainly that has not been the case through its existence thus far.
Well, I don't know. I guess maybe Firaxis is like on this kick of, you know, letting us know about things early, you know. Hey, there's a patch coming out someday. And there's a DLC coming out. And it has nothing to do with the release of the movie Thor coming out on May 8th. See you guys.
That'd be great. You go to see that movie and like part of the preview is, you know, coming soon to Civilization 5.
The Norwegian skiers from Denmark. Yeah.
Or conversely, you get the Denmark DLC and it installs, and then there's a pop-up. Hey, do you want to find out what movie theaters are showing Thor in your area in the next little while? What? Cross-promotion. From Bam Bam on our topic suggestion thread over on Opposin. Hi guys, thoroughly enjoyed episode 116 and looking forward to today's thrilling adventure into wacky punnery, lively banter, and expert analysis of all things Civ, unquote. Colon, blush, colon.
Ooh.
Continue. I regretfully admit this post is arriving just under the wire, but if your panel needs a throwaway topic, I'd like to hear your take on the paltry lack of resource variety, and whether or not you might agree that re-including those found in Civ 4 might add a bit more flavor to the game. Granted, corporations no longer exist, however, and especially on huge maps, the inclusion of a larger palette of food, luxury, and strategic tiles might accidentally be a good thing. At any rate, given time constraints, I'll simply leave it at that for now. Catch you on the cast. Civilly, bam. Smiley face.
I have mixed feelings about it. You would have to change the balance of the game a little bit to compensate for this, just because when you have more variety of luxuries, you have more potential to abuse the AI through selling them. And you also have more potential happiness pre-improvement in city. So if you are lucky enough to get a wide variety of happiness resources early in the game, you have the option to trade it off for gobs of gold or to hoard it for tons of happiness. And if they could keep luck from being such a drastic factor in this sort of thing, I'd be more inclined to do it or to favor it. But I still have that concern with the spawns, because spawns have been a problem in every Civ title I've played ever. So not too happy about that. But I think it could certainly add some flavor to the game. And if they balance the game around it initially, then it would be a good thing for the game, really. I mean, they could just balance that each individual resource is less valuable from a gold or luxury standpoint or something along those lines, and then add more of them, certainly.
I'll echo what Phil has said, but also Bam Bam. It sounds like that you are looking for, more resources on the map. I'd be curious to know what map types you've been playing, because I know there are some, and admittedly I don't know off the top of my head, but you can set a resource amount either, you know, from standard and down to even sparse. I've tried that, and I've definitely regretted that. Or you could also put it on abundant. I don't know, practically speaking, how that compares to standard. I haven't done a lot of that, and I don't know if that, even if you've tried that, perhaps you're still looking for more, but short of you know, any other modifications to the game, that may be a setting to try to see if perhaps you prefer those map types that allow you to say resources abundant. And I also don't know, if I recall correctly from Civilization 4, there were some maps that wouldn't allow you to change certain settings, but if you went to one map type that allowed you to change that particular setting, say resources, for example, or whatever, and then you switch to another map type that didn't allow it, that setting would actually carry over to that map type, even though it didn't come up as an option. I don't know if that's possible in Civ 5, but at least in Civ 5, I would recommend finding a map type that allows you to change that and see if it, you know, at least is a more positive experience for you in terms of, I think it's luxury resources. You were saying that you were looking for in particular. And I guess short of that, if people are ungrateful, then some more happiness buildings and or trading for those luxury resources that, say, other civs have that you don't.
If they're being ingrates, just take away their food. Don't let them grow or reproduce. You know, screw those ingrates. You want to only reward people who like you. And that's now that you mentioned that you play on huge, that does make me think that maybe they should have more or less variety of resources based on the map sizes, actually. You know, when you have larger map sizes and more civilizations, then having more resources would make sense in that context, as opposed to like a standard map or a smaller one. And it shouldn't be that hard. You know, you could even have different luxury resources in each game, but just cap the number of different available luxury resources based on map size. That sounds like a good idea to me, potentially.
All right. And so there's nothing else to Bam Bam's message. Thank you very much for that.
Call in today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301. 637 Polly.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-Polly.
You can Skype us at the Polycast or email us at thepolycast@gmail.com.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast and Revcast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
And at the risk of going a little off topic, when you're giving your explanation, Phil, that noise in the background, was that your cell phone?
Yeah, that was. I was rather surprised, as I almost never get calls at noon on Saturday, but there you have it, I got one.
Okay, so a little bit of Polycast history reference. If anyone who is listening in the chat right now knows who this is indicative of a past regular co-host, if you're able to put the individual's name, then you will win an imaginary cookie. Ooh, cookie!
I love imaginary cookie. They have the best calorie efficiency out there, those imaginary cookies. So if you can learn to enjoy them, then certainly I recommend them strongly.
Disclaimer, regular Polycast co-hosts are excluded from the imaginary cookie consideration.
I can come with my own imaginary cookies, thank you very much. I am skillful in that regard.
The cookies are a lie.
An imaginary cookie goes to Civ Colonel Mustard, or just Colonel Mustard, who correctly guessed Imran, although...
kind of was coughed out a little bit ago, but yeah, we'll give you the imaginary cookie anyway, because you were on the ball with your response.
And if you remember his last name, then I will let you choose what flavor the imaginary cookie is.
I bet he does.
Otherwise, it's going to be plain.
You get two flavors if you can spell that last name correctly.
The plain cookie.
Close enough.
Yeah, there you go.
All right, so Joel, you tell us in the chat, what flavor is the imaginary cookie that you're now going to receive? Not to put you on the spot or anything on a live show, but...
We're going to judge him on a cookie.
Fruit. What? Passion.
Huh. Ooh, chocolate chip. All right. An imaginary chocolate chip cookie goes to Colonel Mustard.
You get the passion fruit cookie as a bonus.
Woo!
What's it with phones today? Shut up.
Oh, someone else wanted an imaginary cookie.
I turned mine off. It's almost certainly because of the NFL draft going on. Someone's calling me about that. But we'll deal with that later. Civ is more important for right now.
Just for right now? Okay, I'm not going.
It's the NFL draft, okay?
Yeah, it's kind of like when you're picking kids at the soccer game in elementary school and you don't want to get picked last. The NFL draft is like that, except for you're not going to be the one picked last. It's awesome.
Thanks for bringing up memories, Phil. Appreciate it.
Poor Dan.
Awkward childhoods for life. This has been Polycast number 117. 117. Yeah, and we have been joined here by our three four regular co-hosts.
Oh, yeah, what?
Lisa's not counting herself. You have to count yourself, Lisa. Come on now.
With our four regular co-hosts, including me, 3 + 1 = 4. Dan Quick, first of all.
And the points don't matter. Just like the sunshine coming through your home office window.
What?
And our Mock Solution.
me more of the caffeine. Yes, now. Okay, thanks. Bye.
And the me and team.
I find myself doing all kinds of exploring.
I know he doesn't mean it that way, but... All right.
It's the affectation. Very good, Phil. Very good.
And our guest co-host, Onan Dogas.
Yeah.
Dirt. Yeah. And, of course, lastly, me, I guess. And, yeah, it's been great, everybody.
Oh, hi.
Oh, hi.
Oh, Dan?
Dan, I'm getting it.
Welcome to episode Echo of Polycast. Oh, no, wait, it's 117.
Let us know how the audio is. Is the feedback gone now, Mackie?
The feedback, but you're garbly.
Yeah. I'm garbly?
Loud.
And loud, okay.
I don't think more than usual.
Yeah, it seems about normal.
I'm just as garbly and loud as I usually am. Okay.
Okay. Maybe it's just me.
I think we have John now, because I hear Phil in stereo.
Yeah. Yeah, I hear myself in stereo also.
Don't you always hear Phil in stereo?
And that was Lisa, by the way, that background noise. That was not John's fault this time.
Sorry about that.
Lisa's trying to frame John. Nice job, Lisa. Jeez.
You caught me red-handed. Oh, my goodness.
All right, is my mic working now?
Yes. Hello.
Yeah.
I did pronounce your username properly right earlier. Onondaga. Is that right?
Onondaga, but whatever.
Onondaga it is. All right.
Yeah.
All I heard was, yes, Dan, you pronounced it properly, so. I'll echo what Phil has said, but also, Bam-Bam, I'd be curious, and the fact that you're also in the chat. And now my phone's ringing. What the heck?
It's Phil.
You're after us. The happy Polycast.
Call from Imran Siddiqui. What?
The spirit of Imran is trying to contact us.
Oh my gosh. I'm not interested in cross promotion of Product X. I hope nobody called their product X, because I just gave you a free plug. But
I'm going in the right direction here. Bam Bam said it was him that was calling you. Well, way to troll us, Bam Bam. Way to troll us. Two thumbs up for me.
I'd be curious to know, and I was saying the fact that you're in the chat will make this a bit more interactive. Stop beeping in the background, cripes. Anyway, I'm easily distracted today. Well, except for Mac, you can do that as many times as you want. And,
Oh, God. What? What are you talking about?
I don't know.
Phil, that's one of the few honest things you've ever said on the show. No.
Yes, okay. Now we know that Phil lies all the time. Especially when he's telling us about, you know, peace weights and everything. Oh, yeah.
Montezuma is actually really peaceful.
I know. I know. I did it the other day.
They're at least just get away from Phil right now.
Yeah, that sounds like...
I was also... never mind, I forgot what I was going to say. Let's keep going.
No, but what you were going to say, Lisa, is that you forgot what you were going to say.
Oh, yeah, thanks.
Yeah, because at random times, she'll just say that for reasons we cannot describe. I forgot what I was going to say. Okay.
Sorry.
Yeah, we don't know why Lisa says it, you know. I mean, she's a woman, and I'm a guy, and I don't understand women, so...
Ah, yes. So it really is just a question.
The base has been updated.
What?
Nice. Whoa, what was that?
Yeah, we have CreatureBoy11 in the chat saying, hello, what is this?
If you don't know, what are you doing here, man?
That's a response here. We are recording episode 117 live, and I'm talking about typing this while.
Excellent. Well, that's pretty descriptive there, and pretty accurate, I would say. Certainly. No one would accuse you of leaving anything out.
Record date April 30th, 2011. Civilization 4 and Civilization 5 sound clips copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.